Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. My guest is Steve Greenberg. He's the host, creator, and producer of a new podcast called The Speed of Sound. And I've definitely found myself listening to more podcasts lately, just kind of a lot of events coalescing to make that happen. I think just my interest in listening to the news is maybe slightly dimmed the past 6-8 months or so. And then, you know, I spend so much time working on preparing the radio show that sometimes when I'm not doing that, I have ear fatigue and I just do not want to listen to music. So I need something that's, you know, spoken word. And if it's not news, it's podcast. So I've gotten some great podcast advice from listeners and from to the podcast and to the radio show, but I have not, and I've heard some great episodes, but I have not found a podcast that, like this one, that, you know, in since that Beatles one, producing the Beatles, I interviewed the guy from that radio show last year, from that podcast last year, and so this is the first podcast since that one that I've really just fell in love with, listened to every episode. I would say to you that I would hardly recommend that you find the episode that sounds like your cup of tea and you start with that one. I think that'll be your, because they're really varied in subject matter. So some great stuff, and I think you'll end up listening to them all. But I think to get into it, pick the one, the Beatles one or the Twist one or the Monster Mash one or the Disco one, whatever. Pick whatever sounds right to you. And then just enjoy. I think you'll love it. Hope you're doing well. I hope you're not going crazy. You never know. And that's it. Meet Steve Greenberg and Speed of Sound podcast. Like I said, I loved it. Talk to you soon. Okay, I was driving to Delaware recently, and a friend of mine had recommended the Speed of Sound podcast, which I have been talking about all morning, and I just went totally nuts on it. It was like, I am the exact person this thing was made for. I've listened to the whole season, and I wish there were more, and so welcome and congratulations to the presenter and producer, Steve Greenberg. Welcome, good morning.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm so pleased you're here. You are a Grammy award-winning record executive, and correct me if you think I'm wrong here, but I think one of the reasons this podcast is so good is because you have always been a guy who's had a knack for figuring out what makes a hit song, and you have a huge amount of curiosity, and you sort of developed these things in your record business days, and so it's this natural curiosity that drives these stories, and I think the listeners feel that, and you know, it's like you're almost giddy exposing this information.
Yeah, I mean, I'm both a historian of pop music and a practitioner of it. So, you know, I kind of use my knowledge of the history of how other things succeeded or why they failed to try to figure out how we can get new artists and new projects to succeed. And, you know, I think that there is a framework that I have in my mind about how records move through different audience groups in society on their way to either becoming a hit or flopping. And I've always kind of applied that idea to all the projects I've done. And on the Speed of Sound podcast, I think because I've been doing music business stuff for, you know, over 3 decades, I'm able to look at the history of what happened over time and go, wait a second, why'd they do that? Let's think about that. Like, why would a record company do that? And you go, oh, well, that's obvious. They did that because of this. And it really enables you to kind of think about the process in a way that's more illuminating to the listeners if you've actually, you know, been in that situation 100 times over, and you can go, okay, I know in that situation they're gonna do this, they're gonna flip the record over and play the B side, they're gonna pull the record from the marketplace, whatever it is, and you kind of can understand the rationale behind what the various players are doing.
In your experience, did other record company guys work with that same level of analytical thinking about how past strategies have and haven't worked and how they apply to whatever the current project is?
I'm sure that everyone has their own method, and I'm sure many of them are quite sophisticated. My particular origin story is that I was a master's student at Stanford under a man named Everett Rogers, who created what's known as the diffusion of innovations paradigm, which is that thing that kind of explains how any new idea or product moves through society. And if you've heard those terms over the years, like early adopters and laggards and all those things where you talk about how who's the first group to adopt a project and how did they find out about it, and then the next group, who were they and did they find out about it a different way and why did it take them so long to get into it? And then you kind of move through the different groups in society and eventually you get to the laggards, who are the last people to pick anything up. That was my framework that I brought to the record business. And I was very blessed to be able to work with the guy who actually created all those terms that people use all the time now in marketing. So when I like look at a record chart and I see a record moving up and down the chart in a kind of bell curve, I go, okay, these people on the first week, these are the early adopters, and these people on the 40th week, they're the laggards, and these other people are the ones in between, fit the other categories, and let's figure out how the record got to all those people. And then when we put out a new record, let's figure out how we can get to all these different groups over time.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I think it is a unique approach that's kind of unique to you. One other reason I think the podcast is so successful is that it's a podcast. You're telling stories about music, so audio is the right medium to deliver those stories with tons and tons of detail, which you present.
Yeah, I found that basically the deeper you go down the rabbit hole, the more people are excited about it. I think when we first started the project, some people involved on the production side were thinking, oh, let's make it a little bit more of like a easy glide over the topic. And I said, I don't think anybody who actually would bother to listen to this podcast wants it to be more superficial. Like if you're tuning in the first place, you probably want me to go as deep as possible. And so we've always gone with that idea that like this podcast is for people who are truly interested in the topic and they'd rather hear more about it than less. Like what I did four episodes about disco.
Yeah.
As you know, since you listened to the podcast. And originally, again, some of the people involved on the production side were like, you know, you're doing two episodes on disco? You can't do two, just do one. And I said, oh, I think it's going to take two. And then, of course, I'd get through two. And I go, well, you know, bad news is I've only gotten to 1976, you know, so I need to do another one. And then I do another one. They go, bad news, I've only gotten to 1978. And so we ended up doing four episodes. But I think in some ways, those are like the most fully fleshed out episodes, because it really tells the full story of disco from the beginning to the implosion and doesn't leave anything out.
Yeah, absolutely. We haven't really discussed what happens when you listen to this podcast. So just, I want folks listening now to understand, basically you ask yourself, how did something happen? And then you back up sort of to the earliest point. And then, like you said, you just work your way till you get back to that thing blows up. And the level of detail is extremely intense. And if anything, I would say this is, you know, overproduced. I mean, it's not overproduced for me or you, but you know, and I guess another reason this thing is so successful to me, the reason it works so well, is because, you know, obviously this is a commercial project, but you are not doing this for money. There's no way, because you would make like 20 cents an hour, because the level of detail is so intense in this thing. I mean, how long does it take to get one episode made?
You know, every time I do an episode, I'm like a college student getting ready for finals week or getting ready to turn in a final paper. Every episode, I'm sure, takes, I don't know, 40 or 50 hours of work, from researching it to writing it. And then really recording it is the easiest part. I know that for every single episode, I pulled at least one all-nighter, like I was an undergrad somewhere, which, you know, was a whole, you know, an experience that I hadn't experienced since I was a kid. But it took a lot of work, and I definitely didn't do it for the money. There's, you know, it's a tremendous amount of work to do. And I'm doing that also while running a record label. So it was kind of like my sideline.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, that and the fact that, like I said earlier, you are not some disconnected host. You are deeply attached to getting these stories told. I think that's what, you know, one of the reasons that makes the whole project so likable. And you know, I keep using the word stories, and I think that's really important, because this is not just facts about music. You know, these are woven together stories that makes this whole thing have a very, very broad appeal, I think, you know?
Well, these are all stories about people. Ultimately, everything that happens, you know, in music is something that a person did, and they did it for a reason, and they had either support or opposition, and they either had to overcome something or they rode the wave. And so I'm telling the story about people, and they're very colorful people, many of them, especially in the earlier days of rock and roll and soul music. There's a lot of crazy characters, some of who were, who were gangsters, but also music lovers, like people who were really kind of complex people, who had good qualities and bad qualities. And I like to tell the stories of those people. And I also love the fact that no matter what subject I come up with, there are some people who just show up again and again and again. Like they had their fingers in everything. You know, somebody like Morris Levy, who owned a lot of record labels from the 50s through the 80s, you know, just shows up in everything from The Twist to Sugar Hill Gang, you know, and he's involved in all of those, you know, and or somebody like Dick Clark, who had American Bandstand, is just, you know, a gatekeeper for, you know, four decades of rock and roll. And so he just keeps showing up. And so I have a lot of fun with that. You know, it's kind of funny to me to see like the fingerprints of the people who were behind Cameo Parkway Records in Philadelphia and how much influence those people had both at Cameo Parkway and in the places where they went afterwards. Mm-hmm. So you just see that these same guys are, they're lifers, they're music lifers, and they just figure out a way to make it work no matter what the trend is.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I want to remind folks, Steve Greenberg is our guest, and the podcast we're talking about is called The Speed of Sound, and I totally, you know, binged on it, totally, totally recommend it. Let's talk about some of the episodes. You are the executive who took Who Let the Dogs Out, which is the first episode in the first season of Speed of Sound. And you found the song, and it's an incredibly long process until it became a hit record. You just had this idea, this song could be a hit record, and you made it happen. How long till that day you heard that, and then the record was on the charts? How long was that interval?
It was about 2.5 years from the time that somebody came into my office with a demo of a very bad version of the song to the point where I actually put out the version by the Baha Men, which ultimately became the hit. And it was 2.5 years of just trying to find out who wrote the song and trying to find somebody to sing the song and trying to find a record label to put out the song. And, you know, all of those things proved to be challenges. But in the end, it all worked out, and it's one of those great Cinderella stories, because the Baha Men who did the song, of course, had been kicking around for decades before that, and then they finally had their big moment.
And how many records sold?
Who Let the Dogs Out sold about 4 million albums worldwide.
That's crazy.
And it won a Grammy.
Wow. Let's talk about my favorite episode was the episode about the Beatles, and it tells the story. Again, these are all about 1 hour long episodes. It tells the story about how the Beatles went in 6 weeks from being just about unknown. You know, Capitol was not putting out their records. Nobody was playing them on the radio in America, to becoming that band who played on the Ed Sullivan Show that every single person knows. I mean, it changed the total history, a huge turning point, you know, in history. I love that episode. Are you discovering a lot of this when you're doing the research yourself? I mean, is this a fun journey for you?
I start with the advantage that I've sort of studied pop music for many, many years. So I kind of know a lot to start with, which really gives me that advantage where I know what I want to find out and I kind of know where to look. Right. And those are the two greatest advantages you could have when you're researching anything. If you know what you're trying to find out, and if you kind of know where the best place to look is, right, you've got a head start. So these are all episodes where I know a fair amount about the topic, but I do a ton of original research for the episode. The Beatles story is incredible because you nailed it. It really attempts to answer one question. How do you go from completely unknown to the biggest thing in the universe in 6 weeks? But how does that happen? Right. And the Beatles, you know, besides being great, right, and they start by having the great product, if you will, right, that everybody's going to love if they get exposed to it. They had a lot of good timing in a way. And some of it was timing that was to their benefit, even though it was a tragic time. You know, they hit big right after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and America was in a real funk and it was looking for something to help bring it out of the funk. But so many things just kind of had to go right for the Beatles to happen. And some things that went wrong turned out to be to the Beatles' benefit. Like the single biggest thing that went wrong that was to their benefit was that Capitol Records kept passing on the Beatles' releases in America, even though all of these songs were being hits in England, bigger and bigger and bigger hits in England. In fact, Beatlemania was becoming bigger and bigger in England. But for some reason, the American label of Capitol Records, decided that it wouldn't work in America. So they kept passing on the records. And that forced the British label of the Beatles, EMI, to license the records to all these little tiny indies just to get them out in America. And so what happened was, when I Want to Hold Your Hand started to explode over Christmas week of 1963 and into early 1964, all of these little labels that owned the rights to one or two Beatles singles rush released them back into the market. And so all of a sudden, there were like four Beatles records on the radio all at once. And so America fell in love with the Beatles as opposed to falling in love with I Want to Hold Your Hand. And that made all the difference. Capitol Records never in the world would have put out four songs at once. They would have done one song, and then it would have gone up and down the chart, and then they would have done another one, and so on and so on. But because of the mistake of not putting out those early records, all of a sudden the market was flooded with all these great Beatles songs that had all gone to number one in England. And America was ready for it because they were in that certain mood after the Kennedy assassination and wanted something happy and exciting and new and fresh to take them out of that funk. And it all just came together. For me, the most fun about the Beatles records, there were two questions that I really wanted to understand. And I answered them both in the course of a lot of research. And they actually were hard questions to answer, believe it or not. The first one was that we all know that 70 some odd million people listened to the Beatles when they were on Ed Sullivan in February. But if you read the history of that period, you always see in passing that there was some sort of presentation of the Beatles on the Jack Parr Show in early January of 1964. And no one really talks very much about that. But I was really curious about it. And I watched the episode, and on the episode, he licensed a performance of the Beatles performing She Loves You in a studio for the BBC. And Jack Parr really doesn't like the Beatles. He makes fun of the Beatles throughout the whole episode and just dismisses the whole thing as being silly. But he does show a whole performance of the Beatles playing She Loves You. And this is January 3rd, 1964. And I thought to myself, well, we all know how many people watch the Ed Sullivan Show, but I wonder how many people watched the Jack Parr Show. And it was really hard to get that information because back then the Nielsen ratings of TV weren't just published like every week like they are now in all kinds of places. And you know, now they're available online. But then for years they were available weekly in Variety and The Hollywood Reporter and those kind of places. Back then, you used to get sort of quarterly ratings. Like I went through all the trade magazines and I saw that every quarter they would do some summation of the ratings of the different TV shows, but you couldn't find any weekly data at all. And then finally, I had a friend who was a producer at the Today Show, which is NBC, which is the same network that the Jack Parr Show was on. And I asked her, do you have an archive like where you have the Nielsen ratings? And she did. They did. And so she looked in the archive for me, and she found out that 32 million people watched the Jack Parr Show the week that the Beatles were on. And I said, could you find out the week before that? And the week before that, like how many people watched the Jack Parr Show? And it turned out that the Jack Parr Show had a rating that was typically less than half of that. And so you realize that as early as January 3rd, 1964, you have about 16, 17 million additional viewers watching the Jack Parr Show to see the Beatles. And that's really a big deal. And that's really lost to history that really that Jack Parr appearance really was one of the things that really helped make the Beatles explode. I want to Hold Your Hand was on the radio and it was a hot record. And so all the DJs were talking about how the Beatles were going to be on the Jack Parr Show. And all these kids watched the Jack Parr Show and the show had elevated ratings. And then the next day, Saturday morning after watching the Jack Parr Show on Friday night, all these kids went to the local record store and said, could you, sell me She Loves You by the Beatles, which was funny because that wasn't the song that was on the radio. The song that was on the radio was I Want to Hold Your Hand. So the label that had the rights to She Loves You, Rush re-released it into the market. And then on the back of that, the label that had some other Beatles titles, Rush released those back into the market. And that's really how Beatlemania exploded in January of 1964 before the Ed Sullivan Show. So the Jack Parr Show really played a big role in it. And in fact, I found a quote in an issue of Variety from about May or June of 1964 where Brian Epstein actually says, very much in passing, oh yeah, Jack Parr really got things going, and then Ed Sullivan really took it to another level. But he actually credited Jack Parr with having a very major role in it. NBC never took much credit because Jack Parr was so anti-Beatles that he looked kind of foolish in retrospect for making fun of the Beatles. So they've never touted how important that show was to exploding the Beatles in America. And then the other thing that I was really interested in that episode that I found out through quite a bit of research was I was really curious about the role of the transistor radio. I knew just from my studies as a graduate student about a little bit about the history of some radio technology that somewhere around that point was when the really inexpensive off-brand Japanese transistor radios flooded the U.S. market. And I really wanted to find out, like, when was that exactly? And when I finally was able to pinpoint it through going through all kinds of data, I figured out that it actually was Christmas week 1963 was that explosive moment when they all hit the market and every kid got one for Christmas, you know, like a $5 inexpensive transistor radio. And the transistor radio really that Christmas week, which was the same week that I Want to Hold Your Hand came out. And you could imagine, you know, when you get one of those new toys for Christmas, you're just playing it all the time, right? When you got your first iPod or something, you know, 15 years ago for Christmas, and you just listen to it all day long. So you had all these kids who had this brand new toy, which was a transistor radio. And they had this brand new song on the radio called I Want to Hold Your Hand that they heard over and over and over again for all of Christmas week. So that really by the end of Christmas week, it was really the number one song in America, even though it didn't come out until December 27th. Mm. Took about 5 days for it to become the biggest song in the country.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And that is sort of the level of detail that you provide for every single part of every single story. You let nothing slip by. There's an episode about Rapper's Delight, and sort of you dub it the song that ignited hip hop. And you interview a lot of people. And I'm wondering, when you're doing these interviews, do folks tell you stuff that they say is off the record?
Let me think about that. I don't think anyone's ever said anything that they said, oh, this is off the record. You can't use that.
You do seem to get actually, the dirt pretty, you know, especially that's a pretty contentious story just about who did what and who should get the credit for it. You do two parts about the twist. Why was the twist so important? How did it change everything?
The twist was really the opening salvo of what we think of as the 60s, that the wild, uninhibited, you know, kind of, you know, experimental, letting it all hang out, being freer with your body, being freer with your mind, all those kinds of things that we associate with the 60s. The first time that idea reared its head in the general public was the twist, because the twist was the first dance that you danced alone, and it was a dance where you were shaking your pelvis, and at the time it was considered quite sexual and even lewd by some people. And the twist really sort of like opened the Pandora's box, and the 60s kind of jumped out of the box, and everything that happened afterwards almost seems in retrospect like a natural progression from the twist. Mm. And what's also interesting about the twist is that it had a kind of double life. It lived and died as a teenage record the way all rock and roll records did back then. Teenagers were really the only market for rock and roll back then. And then all of a sudden, about 10 months later, it became a phenomenon among adults. And it was the very first time that adults had ever really paid any attention to rock and roll and partook in it, cared about it, wrote about it, thought about it. Until the twist, rock and roll was just like stupid music for kids. And then all of a sudden with the twist, you had, you know, everybody's dad and mom and uncle doing the twist at parties and at weddings and bar mitzvahs and all those things. And it was suddenly a thing that everybody did. And it was the first time that actually like people, you know, kind of over the age of high school said, okay, I can get into this rock and roll thing. This is okay. This is fun. And then it never stopped after that.
You know, I remember when I was a kid, I was too young for the twist, but Chubby Checker was still around, you know, on the Mike Douglas show or whatever, doing this. It was still, but I think he's a little bit forgotten to history. So it's nice to remember that is, I think, a huge turning point, and you make the point really well. You mentioned earlier a four parts about disco, and it's super, super interesting. It makes me think about something, a theme that goes throughout the show over and over. This idea that music is sort of a derivative art form, and do people have the right to be upset when someone takes their idea and then, you know, successively it blows it up until it becomes this mainstream thing? And there's always these people who feel like you stole my thing, but that's just part of how it goes.
Sure. I think it's the same phenomenon, like when you find out about an artist and you're the only one who knows about it and you're very excited, and then you kind of get a little bummed when the artist that you loved and no one else knew about blows up and becomes the biggest thing in the world. You kind of feel like there was this little secret that you had that you owned, and you don't own it anymore. Everyone has it. And I think that disco was kind of like that. Disco started in underground clubs, secret clubs. Some of them were illegal clubs in New York City that were invitation only. And all of a sudden, of course, by the end, there was a disco in every strip mall in America. And everybody's grandfather was doing disco, which is, of course, what helped bring it to an end.
Yeah, yeah. It's a totally fascinating story. And I was a little kid during the disco times, and I remember not quite understanding anything about it, including the disco sucks part. I didn't love, because to me, a lot of the records that you play in those four parts hold up so well. You know, they still just sound a lot better than other alleged trends that sort of came and went. But one of the things that's great also about the disco and the way you cover it and the way the show, the podcast works, is that you've got the chart data. So you can really look at these data points to plot the literal rise and fall of it. You can't argue with the sales.
Yeah, I my mind works in a very chronological way. When I'm thinking of a story, I totally am thinking about it chronologically. So if you listen to the various episodes, you'll see that they really all unfold along a time grid. And yes, you can't argue with the charts, which is one great thing about when you're telling the story about pop music. There are always the charts that you can refer to, and they can always verify or refute what you're saying. When I was a kid, I was a chart nut, and every week I would write down the top 10 songs from Billboard, and I would try to figure out what the top songs of the year would be based on points that I would assign to all the songs based on where they were in the top 10 every week and everything. And I was totally fixated on, Casey Kasem's American Top 40 show, where he counted down the top songs in the country. So I definitely have a very chart-oriented view of the history of pop music. And I think about the history of the charts in some ways as being the chronicler of the history of rock and roll.
Mm. Yeah, that's very interesting. And that's really clear that is in the back of your mind sort of at all times. So there is a Monster Mash episode. There's a couple of episodes that sort of trace how we went from grunge to, boy band pop. And I'm being a little, general here, but it kind of makes me, it really gives you an insight into how the record business works and how guys like you can almost smell a change in the air. Like, sort of like how America was ready for the Beatles, how America was then ready for Hanson and a bunch of boy bands. Am I wrong that is what record label guys do, is they try to predict what's coming next?
Yeah, what good A&R guys are the guys who can figure out what might be popular a year from now, because it's very often it takes that long to develop something, or at the very least 6 months from now. It's pretty easy to figure out what's going to be popular tomorrow, believe it or not. Like, it's relatively easy, but that's not that helpful. It's really helpful to kind of be able to think a little bit further down. I always say that being an A&R guy is like being a quarterback in a football game. You don't throw the football to where the receiver is. You throw the football to where you believe the receiver is going to be in a couple of seconds, right? And then if you're right, it's this beautiful thing where the receiver and the ball get to the same place at the same time and you win. And I think good A&R is like that. It's being able to kind of think a little bit down the field and figure out where things are going to be in a minute, not now. We all know friends who say, I have a great ear. I always know what the hits are going to be. Like, I thought that was going to be a hit the first time I heard it on the radio, And I think to myself, well, yeah, by the time it got on the radio, it was well on its way to being a hit.
Right.
You know,
that journey started years before. Steve Greenberg is our guest, and the podcast is called Speed of Sound. And as I've said, I loved it. Tell me what is going to... You know, I also want to point out that although what we're talking about here is musical minutiae, I really want to emphasize that the podcast, I think, is for everyone who loves music, who loves history, who loves stories about people. It's not just for music minutiae, you know, interested folks. Tell me, what is coming up for season two and when can we hear it?
We're getting ready to start putting together episodes for season two. I don't want to give too much away, but I'm very fascinated by that moment in the early 2000s when suddenly the Disney Channel became a source of major pop stars. And I think that's an interesting story. And again, because I sort of tell these things kind of deep, I'm going to use that as an excuse to go way back to the beginning of rock and roll and look at the very interesting intertwined history of rock and roll and television and how that evolved over the decades and ultimately getting us to that Disney Channel moment when Miley Cyrus and Selena Gomez and the Jonas Brothers exploded as superstars. So I'm interested in that. I have some really ones that might not sound that sexy, but I think are going to be really great. I have one that's looking very deeply at the 1950s revival in the 1970s.
No, that sounds and great.
What fueled that and why did that happen and what did it mean for pop culture? I have another one about the very doldrum-like period in the early 1980s after the death of disco when black music was essentially exiled from pop radio and where there was almost no music by African-American artists on pop radio for about 3 years until Michael Jackson's Thriller came and turned things around. And I want to look at that period and what was going on in America with the rise of Ronald Reagan and a certain different kind of American patriotism and how that impacted pop culture and pop radio and the urban cowboy phenomenon where country music suddenly became very dominant on pop radio. So I want to look at that moment. Again, those things sound kind of nebulous, but they're really good stories and they're good stories that have people at the heart of them. I'm also interested in a subject that I've done a lot of work on over the years, which is Stax Records, the great Memphis R&B label. And I want to do a story that's sort of a little bit of a riff on a liner notes essay that I wrote for a box set a couple of years ago about Stax Records. And the episode will really answer the question of how did Stax Records in Memphis survive all of the traumas of 1968 when Martin Luther King was killed in Memphis just a few blocks away from the studio and the city erupted in flames, when Otis Redding, the biggest star on the label, died in a plane crash, when Atlantic Records, which was their distributor, exercised a very obscure clause in their contract and basically took their entire back catalog. How did they survive all of those horrible traumas to survive as a label and not only survive but thrive and go on to be bigger than ever? So that'll be an episode. And there's a few other ideas that we have that we're tossing around that we're excited about.
When will that stuff be out?
That's a great question. I don't think we're going to start recording until about January. So my guess is probably about March.
Okay. Steve Greenberg, I guess I'm in the mood for some disco. So let's hear some disco music. Folks can find Speed of Sound anywhere they get their podcasts. And I really cannot wait for the next season. I want to thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.